Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn, your host for an hour of medical news, healthcare and science in the news, debate, dialogue, answers to your questions, but via email and in person on the air here at Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I had a lot of short stories, and before going to emails, I'm going to throw out some interesting drug short stories. We are living in a pharmaceutical-inspired age, and the law of unintended consequences sometimes catches up with us. So this one goes out to all of you guys out there who are kind of middle-aged and might be using a testosterone gel. And I prescribed testosterone gel just a couple of weeks ago to a patient, and I forgot to tell him this. And it was one of those things that, oh yeah, I remember this now. Fortunately, the FDA has gone ahead and insisted that there be a boxed warning. So this will be something that when you get your testosterone gel, there'll be a handout that includes it. But for those of you who are already users and may not ever look at the package insert on your refills, scoop is that testosterone gels, which are usually 1%, brand names Androgel and Testrim are the two that are approved for the FDA, but there are also formulated versions out there. And if a man puts that on his arm or his leg and then has skin-to-skin contact with a child, and that could be hugging your grandchild or having little Betty sit on your lap while you're wearing Bermuda shorts, little Betty or little Jimmy, as the case may be, may actually absorb enough testosterone across their skin to develop complications. There's even some question that it could happen as a result of exposed clothing. And we're not talking about little side effects. We're talking about enlargement of the penis or clitoris, premature pubic hair, increased libido, aggressive behavior, stuff that we really don't want to have. Yes, I know I've talked about this before, and I want to say it again because the FDA just announced that they're thinking this is a serious enough thing to put a black box warning out. So it were good enough to say once, 'twere good enough to repeat, says the FDA. Getting on my proton pump inhibitor, iHorse, you know that that's a drug that is widely used, I think a little too widely used, and a couple of stories backing me up on that. This one coming out on May 1st, this was in the New England Journal of Medicine, not exactly a fringe journal, and it looked at the use of proton pump inhibitors to help control asthma. Now, it's logical that this would be tried. Something like 50% of all asthma patients experience gastroesophageal reflux. It's probably related to the drugs that are used for asthma. But the symptoms are often absent in people with asthma. They can have asymptomatic reflux that you pick up on pH monitors. So the concept was, well, if a person has severe asthma and they're having acid reflux, maybe that acid is actually getting up into the lungs and causing some of their asthma. So let's put them on a PPI and see if we help them. In this case, the patients received a very high dose, about twice the normal dose of esomeprazole, which is one of the stronger proton pump inhibitors. I think that one's Nexium, if I remember correctly, the trade name. And the study failed to show an improvement in asthma or variations in the urgent care or emergency room visits. So, good idea, doesn't pan out. Why would you maybe not want to keep those people on proton pump inhibitors just in case? Well, this study also published recently, this is in the Journal of the American Medical Association, May 27th, 2009, looked at pneumonia. This was a large urban academic medical center in Boston, Massachusetts. I would guess with an electronic medical record, since the methods of this study were data mining of the electronic medical record. But there were 63,000 admissions, and proton pump inhibitors or H2 blockers were ordered in 52% of these admissions. It's become kind of a standard. In fact, on most of the standard orders at our own hospital, it's a given that proton pump inhibitors will be there as an option. Would you like fries with that, doctor? Basically, most of us check it, or many of us do. And turns out we shouldn't, because in this study, they looked at the rates of hospital-acquired pneumonia, and they found that the group getting acid suppressive medication had more than double, an odds ratio of 2.5, in other words, 2.5 times more hospital pneumonia. Now, when they massaged the data and looked at risk factors and tried to normalize it, the odds ratio dropped to 1.3%. That's for proton pump inhibitors. But when they separated out the histamine receptor antagonists, those are the Zantacs and the Tagamets of the world, and they did not show an increased risk of hospital-acquired pneumonia in that group. So realistically, proton pump inhibitors, besides only being approved, by the way, by the FDA for 8 weeks at a time, being originally used for people with Barrett's esophagitis, a precancerous condition that probably does warrant aggressive medical therapy, even risky aggressive medical therapy, given the diagnosis you're avoiding, has generalized across our population to become the drug of choice for minor heartburn. It's even available over the counter. This is a colossal mistake. These drugs should be used for short-term aggressive therapy, and then a person should be backed off to less aggressive therapy unless they have precancerous changes in their esophagus. Then I'll spot you, risk versus benefit. Long-term effects of this that we know about are vitamin deficiencies, which could lead to neuropathy and brain damage, and osteoporosis, which begins to occur very soon after the initiation of these drugs on a regular basis. We're talking a couple of years here, folks. We really need to rethink our use of this medication, particularly since more of them are about to go generic, and you know what that means. They get cheaper. I've got a couple of emails here. This one from Mary in Marblemont, Washington. Dear Dr. Don, I'm a healthy 65-year-old woman. I have mild symptoms of restless leg syndrome for years, although I didn't know what it was or that it had a name. I called it electric leg in my own mind. Until recently, it was only an occasional annoyance, but in the last couple of years, it's gotten much, much worse. The odd sensations have turned to real pain, and the occasional occurrence has become almost nightly. I've gone online to read about possible treatments and am very wary of the solutions offered, dopaminergic medications, benzos, or narcotics. Do you have any alternative or functional medicine approaches that might help me? Thanks for all you do. A faithful podcast listener, Mary Kay. Yes, Mary Kay, I do have some thoughts for you there. One of them would be that exercise that you do should be in the morning and not in the evening. There's something about doing exercise in the evening, probably related to electrolytes, that seems to worsen the restless legs. So if you're trying to get a good night's sleep, doing your exercise in the morning is a good idea. The second one is a common electrolyte, magnesium. And I have had a lot of success since I learned about this at a functional medicine conference about 5 years ago. I've been using it widely and with excellent results in people with restless legs. And the dosing of magnesium, a lot of us are actually magnesium deficient, apparently, either because we're not absorbing it or because it's not bioavailable in high enough quantities in our food. Processing takes out a lot of the natural magnesium that would otherwise be bioavailable, so that could be part of it. But for whatever the reasons, people often respond to magnesium. My favorite forms of magnesium are the citrate and the glycinate, G-L-Y-C-I-N-A-T-E. Glycinate also is a precursor for GABA, which is one of our relaxing hormones, and so maybe it helps with sleep. I'm not really sure about that, but I think the magnesium is what's helping the muscles. Magnesium is a natural muscle relaxant and stabilizes nerve cell membranes, probably penetrates the blood-brain barrier very fast and rapidly. The jury is still out exactly how much of restless legs is central and how much of it is peripheral. Other things that can be helpful: passion flower extracts and chamomile. These are my two standbys for helping with sleep. And I try really hard to stay away from the dopaminergic drugs, just because there's, when you mess with brain transmitters at that level, in changing the way that the neurotransmitters are broken down, which is what these drugs do, you risk the feedback loops of the brain creating more neurotransmitter. And we know that in Parkinson's disease, where we use high levels of these drugs, we do see progressive resistance occurring over several years' time. And with something like restless leg syndrome, where you're going to be on these drugs for a long while, I just would leave messing with directly with the dopaminergic system as a last resort after everything else had been exhausted. And I'd sooner give someone Vicodin, really, than Requip for restless legs, just because I don't know about the potential for long-term pushback from the brain, which is not a structure I care to mess with unduly. And we're going to our first caller. It's Maria Elena in Salinas. Hello, Maria Elena. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Just great.
I have a friend who has been diagnosed as being stage 2 hepatitis, and I was wondering what he might be able to do to help his condition. They're going to give him in about October for some reason, what is it called, interferon, and then some other pill, the name of which he can't remember, but I was hoping we could find something, and he's had a biopsy, by the way, hoping we could find something that would be a little less radical.
Okay, so your friend has stage 2 hepatitis C, is that?
Yes.
Is that what we're talking about? Because you didn't specify, but usually that staging refers to liver biopsy results.
And, yes, Hep C.
Right. And so when we talk about Hep C, it's important to keep in mind that we're dealing with a disease that has lots of different manifestations. And one of the early manifestations is based on the genotype. And so there's genotype 1, A and B, genotype 2, genotype 3. And that's an important distinction because the genotype of hepatitis C that you have is highly predictive of the success of peginteron therapy. And so the interferon and the antivirals that he's given, the idea here is that you're giving an antiviral drug and you're giving a drug that downregulates the inflammation that's being generated by the virus. And hopefully between the two, you're able to reduce inflammation and also kill off the virus and stop its suppression. And it's ribavirin is the other drug that he's being offered. This combination of therapy works well at eradicating virus in people with genotype 2 and 3. It's got like 90% success rates. In genotype 1, it's got a 50% success rate. And the major drawback to this drug combination is the side effect profile. I've had several patients go through it. It's pretty tough, okay? It's like giving, you know how you feel before you're bedridden, but when you've come down with the flu and you're tired and you feel blah and your brain's foggy and your body aches. And that's how you feel when most people have those side effects from the interferon. And so if you imagine deliberately giving yourself a coming down with the flu feeling and then continuing that for 6 months, it's fairly disabling and it's really a bit of an ordeal to go through. Now, just like cancer chemotherapy, you go through an ordeal because you want the success at the end of it. And the success rates are there for types 2 and 3. For type 1, it's less of a sure thing, particularly males with type 1. So that's be an interesting factor. I would point you to something in the archives at Ask Dr. Don, but the thing about it, it was Bert Berkson, B-E-R-K-S-O-N, and it was a discussion of use of natural therapies for hepatitis. And Dr. Berkson, who is a retired NIH scientist, very well-qualified guy, he's not a fringe person. He's, I think, very innovative and interesting, but I think he's extremely scientific. Anyway, he has developed a way of treating people for hepatitis, which he freely gives you the recipe. He's not just, you know, got his own little hepatitis treatment center where he has the special formula X. So that's one of the marks of a real scientist. It involves alpha-lipoic acid and milk thistle, which is silymarin, is considered to be the active component there, and selenium. And the relative doses are available on my website if you listen to the thing in context. The doses are something that I don't want to quote you simply because I'm quoting off the top of my head and I'm not sure I remember them exactly and I don't want to say them incorrectly. But there are doses of these things that are not megadoses. They would be used in standard supplementation. and therefore they have a synergy in combination, which is quite interesting. It's Bert Berkson, B-E-R-K-S-O-N, and it was April 28th, 2007.
And how long does one do this?
The interferon, pagan intron therapy is generally 6 months. This other therapy is pretty much ongoing. You want to...
Ongoing, okay.
Yeah, and since they're antioxidants and benign agents, I don't really have a problem with that. But at least anecdotally, and he has published some case studies. I don't think had the funding to do a double-blind study, but he's published case studies. And, you know, you're taking benign agents, putting them in combination, getting a synergy, and getting good results. So if he's type 1 and opts not to do the PEG intron and try this first, I think that would be legitimate. Type 2 means he's got fibrosis. He's got some beginnings of scar tissue in the liver, which if it gets severe, will lead to cirrhosis of the liver and maybe require him to get a transplant. So you don't want to dally here.
No, no. How do we find out what genotype he is?
That's probably known. His doctor probably knows that, but didn't share the information. It's pretty standard to test that.
Okay.
All right?
All right. Yes, thank you so much.
I'm glad to be able to give you some practical advice. Good luck.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And we had a comment on our previous call regarding hepatitis. An off-air caller called to let us know that acupuncture, along with standard hepatitis therapy, is a good combination. Claimed there was good literature supporting this, according to my producer, but I don't actually have any references there. I'll look for them. It seems to me quite logical that acupuncture would be helpful because acupuncture is great for symptoms of side effects. If you discombobulate your system with chemotherapy or interferon or one of these other agents, acupuncture is very good at taking care of settling down perturbations that I think are sometimes created by our very strong pharmaceutical agents and other interventions. Those perturbations are like ripples in a pond. If you damp them down, you don't bounce around as much. And I really like using acupuncture for management of side effects of radiation, of chemotherapy. It stands to reason that it would also be helpful for that. And let's go to Elisa in Aptos. Hello, Lisa, you're on the air.
I want to ask about an itch that I have mostly under my arm. And I've been using something called PRID, P-R-I-D, a drawing salve, but it still itches.
Okay, are there any lumps or bumps under your arm? This is your armpit, right?
Yes, my armpit.
Uh-huh. Any lumps or bumps there?
There are sort of little pimples. Not really a lump, but... in the skin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pimple-like things.
Yeah.
Okay. And are you using any kind of deodorant or antiperspirant?
No, but I've been using a cream, Aveeno baby cream.
Okay. And that was before you developed these lumps or bumps or pimples?
Let me see. Okay. I'm not positive.
All right. Do you shave under your arms?
No.
Okay. So I would say that obviously you can't diagnose, but the most common thing that a person would have that would itch and give you any kind of bump that you could feel, especially pimples, which would be in the skin itself rather than lymph nodes, which are deeper, would be either a dermatitis that was caused by an allergic reaction to a product, an infection caused by contaminated product, or something called hidradenitis suppurativa, which is a inflammation of the sweat glands. It's caused by a bacteria, usually Staph aureus, and it tends to be chronic, and you get these painful, itchy lumps. Now, the treatment for the three is different. So the first thing to do is to stop using anything in the area and give it some time to clear up. If it's an allergic reaction, it should start to improve within a week or so, maybe sooner. So the only thing that you're allowed to put on there for that week is just Benadryl cream, which is available over the counter, and it's an anti-itch medicine. See, I'm not making you be miserable, but I've never seen an allergic to Benadryl cream or Benadryl gel. So go ahead and use that for comfort, but don't put anything else under there, not even soap. Just go ahead and rinse for a few minutes in the shower, but don't use any soap. and see if it calms down, because you may not need to do anything else but just avoid. All right, if it doesn't calm down and you've still got lesions, then it's a very strong possibility that it is the hidradenitis, and that has to be treated with antibiotics. Okay, so at that point, you go off to the doctor. You still there?
Yes, I am. Uh-huh. And this thing that I have here, PRID,
yes,
homeopathic salve, an all-natural drawing salve,
mm-hmm,
is that...
You stop that too.
Stop that also?
You stop that also. First of all, homeopathics are very, very dilute compounds, but in order for it to be a salve, it has to be in a carrier, which means it's going to have oil. Maybe it'll have some perfume. It'll certainly likely to have some kind of preserving agent. If it's all natural, it might be citric acid, or it might be limonene.
I can read you what it says.
No, I'd rather you didn't, because okay, I'm not going to recommend what you're using. Okay. First of all, it hasn't worked for you. Right. And second of all, the problem you're describing doesn't sound like something that a drawing salve would be appropriate for.
Okay.
And it's a good thought, but if it hasn't worked, then I think we have to look elsewhere.
Okay, so what I need to do is get a Benadryl.
If you need something for itching, that's what you use. If you can live with not using anything, then don't use anything.
And if I don't use anything,
yes,
should I wash it or...
Just use water.
Water, no soap of any kind.
Yeah, we're trying to see if it's an allergic reaction, so you're going to back off on any potential allergen. Yeah. You can just do this for a week. If it gets better... Then you were reacting to something. Then you have the job of figuring out what you were reacting to. If it doesn't get better, you go to the doctor. Okay?
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Let's go to another email. This one from Catherine in New Jersey. Dear Dr. Don, I've had eczema since I was a child, but it has become increasingly worse through my teenage years. I'm now 19 and attending college in Oregon. Eczema has affected my hands, causing rough, dry patches as well as the most irritating blisters possible with occasional cracking and bleeding. It's also moved to my face, where I initially would have dry patches on my cheek and forehead, but has since irritated the skin beneath my eye and even the area around my lips. The most recent eczema outbreak happened just this past weekend when blisters appeared on my lips. The dermatologist has described fluocinonide, which is a strong steroid, for my hands, and Protopic for my face. Protopic is a drug similar, actually, to Pegintron. It's an anti-interferon and therefore an immunosuppressant. I've also taken an antibiotic orally for my blisters, which worked at the time, but that was nearly a year ago. My medications have worked, but not extraordinarily. I have to take precaution when using the meds because I figure I may have to use them for the rest of life and do not want to completely wear away my skin. She's referring to the fact that fluocinolide is so strong that it actually causes thinning of the skin. I try my best to use the most gentle soaps and even leave all the dishwashing to my nearly eczema-free family. This past year at school in Oregon, my eczema didn't bother me much. I had an occasional flare-up, which was soon halted by my medication. However, since I've been home in New Jersey, it has only gotten worse. Like I mentioned, I'm wary of to use my medication frequently. Are there any alternatives to the typical eczema care I'm receiving? Well, Kathy, there are a couple of things about eczema. Since you've had this since you were a child, I want to emphasize that you probably have atopy, which is a fired up immune system, basically, an immune system which is going after stuff it shouldn't go after. We have now got excellent research backing up the concept that what gets eczema started in genetically susceptible individuals is not having their bowels get colonized in infancy with the appropriate mix of bacteria. And there are studies in children, taking children with eczema and treating them with bacteria, particularly the Lactobacillus rhamnosus strain, and showing an improvement, quite significant statistically, of their eczema. This also has been extrapolated, and there's a study in asthmatics that shows similar results. Asthma of some types, some subtypes of asthma at least, are often associated with atopy. So there's an exposure somewhere. And that's backed up by the fact that in Oregon, you have less symptoms than you have in New Jersey. Now, the exposures can be psychological. It could be stress. I'll throw that out in case there's a family dynamic operative here. But dietary is much more common. I'm thinking you should look at the differences between how you eat in Oregon and how you eat in New Jersey. And there's quite possibly a variation there in terms of the amount of some foods. And it may be that you are allergic to one of these foods. If you are, it will show up as an IgG allergy, not an IgE. So if you just go to an allergist and ask for food allergy testing, they won't order the right test. So remember that, IgG, G for generalized symptoms, as opposed to IgE, E is for anaphylaxis. Well, that doesn't exactly work, but anyway, as a mnemonic, I'm doing my best here. What I would suggest at this point is the following. See if you get any clues on diet, and if there's a food that you started eating more of when you got back to New Jersey, stop eating that food. Go get some probiotics that contain at least 6 billion organisms of Lactobacillus rhamnosus, and take those 2 or 3 times a day. Get some quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N, which is a bioflavonoid anti-inflammatory that seems to have some immune modulating effects, and go ahead and take that as well. Be sure you go to consumerlab.com and check on the version of quercetin that you buy. Make sure it's one of the ones that they approve, since there's a lot of variation in terms of quality and quantity in health foods and nutraceuticals. There is no centralized inspection body, so consumerlab.com does a decent job at pinch hitting for that. You want to be sure you're getting what you think you're getting. So good luck to you with your eczema, and I hope this advice is helpful to other people with itchy skin. Certainly we've got kind of an itchy energy going on this weekend. One quick one, this from Gloria, who's a regular emailer here. Danger of Pepto-Bismol for children. I just listened to your June 13 podcast where you mentioned Pepto-Bismol as a preventative for intestinal problems while traveling. It's my understanding it's dangerous for children. A 4-year-old friend of my niece died after taking it. I know you mentioned the aspirin sensitivity aspect, but you might want to stress this. Yes, okay, I will stress it. Aspirin is in Pepto-Bismol, or salicylic acid is in Pepto-Bismol, and that is the component that we're concerned about here, is the salicylates. There is a reaction when you take aspirin and you have influenza or varicella called Reye syndrome. It causes fulminant liver failure, and it's fatal, or can be fatal. So aspirin should be avoided in children who have influenza or potential chicken pox. The use of Pepto-Bismol as a preventative for traveler's diarrhea needs to be taken before each meal, and it coats the H. pylori and other bacteria and keeps them from getting rolling. Very effective therapy for that, but obviously children who travel are a separate issue, and I wasn't referencing them. Thank you, Gloria, for having me emphasize that. Let's go to John in Watsonville. Hello, John. Welcome
to... Dr. Don.
Hi there.
I heard your earlier comments about the proton pump inhibitors.
Yes.
And I've been on proton pump inhibitors for about 2 years, and I've repeatedly asked my medical practitioner about duration and any side effects for doing that, and they've just told me to stay on that, and I heard what you said. I believe you said FDA recommended 8 weeks only.
That's what it's approved for. Now, we do non-approved things constantly in medicine, so the fact that it's not approved is indicative that we're on uncharted territory. I don't say that you shouldn't do anything that's not approved for the FDA, because half of the drugs I use for the way I use them isn't approved by the FDA. However, it's important to understand that what you get an approval for is based on what's been tested. And so when you do something that's off-label, off-label is how we refer to using an FDA-approved agent for a non-FDA-approved use. When you do something that's off-label, you're essentially experimenting. And so you want to think about the potential downside risk of going off-label. And if you're going off-label for a short period of time in a drug that's been studied for that duration for another indication, it's not a big deal. When you're going off-label in terms of doing something for a long term, when there are no studies showing that it's a good idea long term, you're asking for trouble. And we're getting the trouble. We're seeing fracture rates that they start to go up 2 years after you go on a proton pump inhibitor. Now, it's a statistical thing, But, I mean, fracture rates, come on. This is not something you want to be dealing with for simple heartburn. What's driving this in this country? A lot of it's concern about malpractice. A lot of it's direct to the consumer advertising. The drugs work. They work spectacularly well. And patient's gone. You've got good throughput when you use these agents, as opposed to having to sit down and do counseling and try to get somebody to change their lifestyle to help their heartburn. You know, the other treatments for heartburn, like weight loss and behavior modification and not pigging out and not wearing pants that are too tight for you and not eating and drinking a bunch and then going into the recliner, those are all hard compared to just popping a pill in the morning. And getting people off proton pump inhibitors is difficult. And so now we've kind of medically, I'm speaking with the we of the medical system and doctors, we've painted ourselves into a corner with this agent because it's difficult to get people off of it. And so once you've been on it for a while, a couple of things happen. Your stomach starts to make more acid-producing cells, and you get what's called hypertrophy of the cells, and the gastrin levels, which is a hormone that your stomach releases to create acid. The parietal cells hypertrophy, you produce more gastrin. So when you remove the drug, there's this huge pushback from the body because you're making a whole lot more acid suddenly than you would ever have made if you never took the drug in the first place.
That's exactly what I was concerned about, and I've actually gone off it a couple of times and gotten that boomerang effect.
Yeah, exactly. So getting off of a proton pump inhibitor, there's no research. There's no data. It's true seat-of-the-pants medicine. I have a protocol that is absolutely not research-based. There's been no double-blind placebo study done because I don't exactly have university funding here. But in my efforts to figure out how to get my patients off of proton pump inhibitors, I have come up with a few pointers. So if you'll get a pencil, I'll kind of walk through them for you.
I'm ready.
All right. So the first thing is, you need to go buy an H2 blocker. Proton pump inhibitors are 95% effective. H2 blockers are about 60% effective. And you need to go buy yourself a big bottle of Mylanta or Maalox because you're going to have breakthrough symptoms. Mylanta and Maalox are acid neutralizers. They don't change the amount of acid you produce, but you can damp down the acid reaction by taking the neutralizer.
That's what I need.
Okay. So the next step is, go to my website and look up under resources, look up the reflux recommendations. This is your anti-heartburn Bible. This tells you all of the things that you are doing that might be contributing to heartburn, and you want to actually start doing the behaviors listed and not doing the behaviors that are listed as not to do really consistently for a while, because it's going to take a while for your body to readjust. And during that time, you're going to need some assistance. So you do all of these things. Then in addition, you're going to stay on your proton pump inhibitor, but you're going to start taking a digestive acid called betaine hydrochloride with your meals. And this is to help you digest your food and empty your stomach.
Right.
You can do that for a couple of weeks, do all the reflux stuff, get your behaviors in line, taper down on your caffeine, taper down on your alcohol, and then you're going to start tapering down on your proton pump inhibitor. And at bedtime every night, you're going to take an H2 blocker so that you don't get nocturnal heartburn, which gets up there and burns the esophageal sphincter and causes problems for you. So a lot of stuff. It's a process. Needs to be done slowly. And when you get breakthrough, that's when you pull out the Maalox at Mylanta and you take some. You take, 30 cc's, a couple of tablespoons, maybe 60 cc's, and you let your body readapt. So the body has great feedback loops. As soon as it recognizes that there's too much acid, it's already hypertrophied those glands. Those glands will start to shut down.
Okay.
It'll take a while for them to go away, but the gastrin levels drop fairly quickly, and you won't have as much acid once you get off the acid blocker. And you'll still protect yourself at night, but during the day you'll have normal amounts of acids, which will feed back into the system. And if you have Barrett's esophagus, if somebody has diagnosed you as having precancerous changes of the esophagus, don't do this, because it's better not to get cancer and to get osteoporosis. I mean, worst case scenario, it's still better to break your hip than have an esophageal cancer. But if you are just one of the many people who had heartburn, or if you're an asthmatic, that somebody told you it would help your asthma. Well, it won't. So, you know, you need to get off of it.
Yeah, I haven't had a precancerous diagnosis at this point. One of the main reasons that I started becoming hesitant to use the omeprazole, is what it is because I'm having trouble with my teeth in lower right and upper right molars, and it feels like calcium loss to me, but I don't know for sure. I never had that before, and my teeth have been checked for caries. There's nothing like that going on, so that was part of my concern, but mostly it was the duration of use.
Yeah. If you can get off of this drug, I think you should. If you can't, reduce the doses. And I just want to throw out to other healthcare professionals out there, people who are still symptomatic and they're on a high dose of a proton pump inhibitor, one of the things that proton pump inhibitors do is they cause bile reflux, which means that the digestive enzymes from the small intestine actually get up into the stomach and then get belched up into the esophagus. And the bile is very irritating. And so if people are having a lot of heartburn symptoms despite high doses of proton pump inhibitors, there's an old-fashioned drug called Carafate that I'll try. And Carafate just coats raw tissue. That's all it does. It's a coating agent. I don't, you know, like it for long-term use if I can avoid it, because it has aluminum in it. And putting aluminum on a raw tissue, you know, I'm not sure how well the body's going to detox the aluminum. But in a short-term trial of concept, if you're seeing a lot of relief with Carafate, then that tells you you've got bile reflux, which is a lot more common than most people realize in the post-proton pump inhibitor world. We were taught that was very rare back in medical school. That's what I learned. It was very rare before we started messing with the digestive system by giving everybody proton pump inhibitors. Now it's not so rare. So that was for the general audience. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Have a great day. Let's go to Bill in Arroyo Grande. Hello, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thank you. I wanted to comment and also ask a question about Hep C. I was interested by your first caller who has a friend who's considering the pegylated interferon.
Yes.
I tried it, and I think ultimately everybody reacts really differently to it. I had several friends who were on it who seemed to tolerate it very well. I did not tolerate it well at all, and I lasted about 2 weeks doing it. I am a stage one, and one of the things that really resonated with me that my hepatologist said was that this is a disease of decades.
Yes.
Not a disease of days.
Right.
And because I'm stage one, I really have time, as long as I don't do more damage through alcohol consumption and other things.
Yeah, and go and Tylenol. Don't forget acetaminophen.
Exactly. Good point.
Okay.
And I think that's often overlooked, that Tylenol does damage.
Yeah.
So that's my comment. And I haven't had a biopsy in 5 years. I'm probably due. But at stage two, there's still a lot of time if there aren't those other abusive behaviors that contribute to liver dysfunction.
Thank you very much.
I've tried to do a lot with diet to control the symptoms. A little bit of a misnomer, but recently I heard that there are certain proteins are not good if your liver function is depressed. Have you heard that? And do you know what proteins they are?
No, I haven't, to either one of those. Proteins are, in general, require some detoxification, but I'm not aware of certain, I mean, obviously a protein is a complicated compound with a bunch of amino acids, so I'm really not sure what that means. But if you find any references and can send them to me or send me a trail, I'll try to chase it down. Okay.
Great. And I was curious if you had any comments, other comments about diet.
Well, I think it's important when you have a inflammatory disease, which is what chronic hepatitis is, to do a lot of vegetables, a lot of juicing, a lot of definitely organic. You really don't want to be giving your body pesticides. And you want to watch what detoxification load you put on your body. So you mentioned alcohol and pharmaceuticals, but certain household cleaners. I mean, the so-called green house cleaners and the so-called green paints and the so-called organic foods are probably a good idea. Just less crap for your liver to deal with.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks, bye-bye.
Let's go to Doug in Santa Cruz. Hello, Doug. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
In 1999, I got a infection, and it was in the bottom of my foot, and it turned out to be, you know, MRS.
MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus.
Yeah, yeah, they called it flesh-eating wound disease.
You were early, 1999.
I was in Hawaii.
Okay, are you diabetic or immunosuppressed in any way?
Not that I know of.
Okay, go ahead.
I had gotten a couple of cases of, what the heck was it called, pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
I was only in my 40s, you know, so maybe I was getting to the point where I was doing the excesses of life were, like, adding up, you know, and I wasn't really aware of it yet, but I was, like, on the fringe.
Okay. Well, two cases of pneumonia, maybe you had some kind of relative immunodeficiency, but nothing overt. So what's your question?
Well, it spread to other organs in my body. The one that it immediately affected was the heart.
Yes.
And I had a heart attack. Whatever it was, the infection got to the heart.
Did it damage the heart valves?
Well, they had to put a stent in there.
Yes.
Because it all closed up.
Right. That's the heart attack. But were the heart valves scarred by the infection as
No.
Well? Okay, go ahead.
No, but one lower left quadrant was affected.
Yes, go ahead.
That was completely compromised. Mm-hmm. So it's 10 years later now. Pretty heavy at the time, but, you know, I see, like, David Letterman and all these people are all going through, like, four or five, six of them in their life, you know, and smoking cigars. So I say, well, I'm not doing too bad then. But at the same time, it's been 10 years. And nothing's happened. You know, I've been doing, like, what they told me to do, and everything's been fine. What is the status of these? I don't know what it is in 2009. Are they replacing them? Or are they saying that they're working great, you just keep going, or what?
Well, what you do with stents is you watch for what we call reocclusion. We've known that when you put a stent in, the area across the stent can block up again.
Uh-huh.
And so we usually look for that with either an echo stress test or an angiogram. And depending on this person's symptoms, we try to be non-invasive. So we'll usually do, there are a couple of studies you can do. One is where you give the person a radioactive substance that's going to be taken up by heart muscle that doesn't get good blood flow. And you look for other areas of blockage. And so you can do that kind of a study. You can also just put the person on a treadmill and use an ultrasound to look at heart wall movement and screen them that way. But people with stents need...
Right, I've had those.
Yeah,
I've had those and I've always come out fine.
Yeah, you need... Well, that's good. That's good because that's an indication that your stent is still open. And not everybody's stent reocludes. A few years ago, we started putting chemicals on the stents trying to figure out a way to slow down reocclusion, and that kind of backfired. Not only did it not slow down, but at least one of the stents seems to increase the rate of reocclusion, so that was an oops. But you don't know until you try. It's the way medicine is. Sometimes it doesn't work better than the old treatment. But you got an old stent, so yours probably doesn't have any drug on it. And it's still open, so that's great. You had a really...
And I've been I exercise regularly,
and
too.
And your cholesterol and HSCRP?
I'm a vegetarian, vegan.
You got the blood results to show me?
Healthy, healthy on all the blood results.
Okay, good.
I get that regularly.
So you make sure that they check an HSCRP, which is high sensitivity C-reactive protein, because that's what...
Maybe I better write this one down.
Yeah, you better. That one's a good one to monitor, because, my friend, that's probably what...
Is that normally done in a blood test?
Normally. Normally would imply that there was a standard that was agreed upon.
Well, normally they look like red blood cells.
No,
white.
There's no way to know whether your doctor ordered it or not. There is no normal.
Okay.
Doctors have different favorite things that they monitor.
Okay. So what do I want to have on my list?
HS, lowercase, capital C, capital R, capital P. But that is important. That's something that maybe what gave you your heart attack back in 1999, because when you had your infection... Your inflammatory mediators and all of these chemical signals in your blood that trigger inflammation went sky high,
mm-hmm.
and that affects blood clotting. And having a massive infection is a big stress on the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had even a little bit of plaque and some of the bacteria that was floating around your bloodstream fetched up in the plaque, it would have caused a massive inflammatory reaction and probably led to your heart attack.
If only I had known about turmeric at that time.
Well, you know, I personally, I think the methicillin-resistant Staph aureus would have looked at the turmeric, and it would have been like the sumo wrestler looking at the mouse, you know.
Yeah.
Ha. You know, and unfortunately, usually Goliath does win, contrary to the story in the Bible. So,
Anyway,
the point here is it sounds like you are doing all that you can do to prevent a recurrence. Bravo for you. The stent will either stay open or it won't. But no, we don't replace them. If they're working, we just leave them where they are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And you're doing all the good stuff that you should be doing.
Is there anything else on the blood test list that, you know?
Well, I'm assuming your cholesterols are normal and that's being monitored. And probably back in 1999, you were checked for hypercoagulability syndromes. But you'd need to look at your old medical records to see about that. But it sounds to me like the infection was the trigger for you.
I definitely believe that. If I had the knowledge that I have now in terms of herbal knowledge and diet and things like that, I really think I could have gotten it under control.
I really think what would have happened is you would have had a bad infection,
yes. And
it might not have caused your heart attack. I'm going to leave that where it is.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I want to thank you for listening. Those callers who didn't get on, if you'll stay on the phone, I will get to you off the air. And you can call back next week. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.